Good to be with you again for the sake of the taping ministry and all. My name is Terry Fredheim. I'm a professor of Old Testament at Luther Northwestern Theological Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota. And have over a couple of weeks a series of presentations on the God of the Old Testament. Also for the sake of the bookstore, they want me to lift up the fact that they have some copies of my book titled The Suffering of God, an Old Testament Perspective, for sale in the bookstore. I won't say anything more than that. I don't know what price of it is over there. The emotions of God. Yesterday we solved everything with regard to the will of God, I understand, and all of you don't have any questions left on that one. And now the emotions of God. It's not very common that we use the word emotions in the same sentence with the word God. We in fact have some difficulties, I think, ascribing emotions to God. We have little difficulty, interestingly enough, talking about the mind of God or the intellect of God, God's thinking, God's speaking. Very little difficulty with those issues. But with regard to emotions or feelings, that's not very common vocabulary when it comes to speaking of God. In used contemporary jargon, we might say that the God of the Christians is a left brain God. Now, isn't that a problem? That's to say, you think about people whom you know, who are intellectuals, whose life is primarily, if not exclusively, a life of the mind. My daughters have a word for those kind of people. They're nerds. They have all these pens in their upper left-hand pocket. And they're not very healthy personalities, because all they can do is think about things and they intellectualize everything. Is God then not very healthy, finally? Because is not God, in most of our conceptions, a God who is sort of a big brain in the sky, who thinks and speaks and intellectualizes and conceptualizes and all of those sorts of things, but a God who does not feel? A God whose emotions are truncated or short-circuited or not evident at all. I think that there is some very real concerns that we as a Christian community ought to have with regard to this understanding of God, not least, as we'll see in a few minutes, because of the testimony of the Scriptures. But interesting what's beginning to pop into some contemporary songs, some new songs with regard to the God we have. Computer language is beginning to pop in. And so you can pick up some songbooks these days that talk about God and computerese. Now, I think that there may well be some continuities between God and the computer, but few and far between, I hope. That brings me to just remind you a little bit of the discussion about will yesterday and how we used human language to talk about God. All of the language that we use to talk about God is human language. It's language from either the human, from interpersonal relationships, occasionally from the natural order or from things that human beings make, but predominantly human, interpersonal. We need to remember that every time we use language to talk about God, there's continuity and discontinuity with the reality which is God. So when we use language like emotions, we want to, and I'm going to affirm very strongly that God has an emotional life, okay? That God has feelings. But when we talk like that, we need to remember that there's both a yes and a no to that. that there are continuities between what we call human emotions and the emotional life of God, and there are some discontinuities, and we want to talk about both continuity and discontinuity. But why is it that we have such difficulty ascribing emotions to God? Why can we say so easily that God shares thoughts with us, God shares ideas with us, but that we can't easily speak of God sharing feelings with us or God displaying emotions toward us? I think it goes back into what we might call the Greek philosophical tradition, where the Greeks had notions of God, where God was impassible. God was not one who had any emotions, under the belief that to speak of emotions, to speak of passions, was to speak of that which was left less than perfect, and hence to ascribe such matters to God would be to ascribe imperfection to God, and that would not be appropriate. And the church has passed on that tradition for generations, and so leading theologians of the church over the centuries have rarely talked about God in terms of feelings or emotions. Now, those of us from a Northern European background, and in this group I suspect that's quite a few, we've sort of resonated with that tradition, because we come from that tradition where the father in the family, and of course God has been largely conceived of in male terms, and so we connect God as male with the father of the family in the Northern European household. And the father in the family in the Northern European household is not one who is to show emotion or feeling. Everything's kind of kept under control, right? The only emotion that is appropriate would be anger, and that gets kind of set outside of the normal emotion or feeling language in many formulations. But father doesn't show emotions. Father, big boys don't cry. We've learned that. It's been pounded into our souls from day one, those of us who are males, right? Huh? Keep a stiff upper lip. I think that we're going to talk on Thursday about the issues of sexuality in relationship to God, but I think that the predominant male character of our language and reflection about God has also affected our talk about feelings and emotions here. That God is one who doesn't cry, who keeps a stiff upper lip, and who is even tempered, always on the same level of response with respect to any relationship that this God might have with the world. Well, I'm going to use the language, as I've intimated, I'm going to use the language of emotion and feeling for God in a number of ways, but I think it's important for us to say something about what it is about God that doesn't quite fit our traditional emotion or feeling language that we use for human beings. Where are the discontinuities? Well, in one respect, and this may be one of the reasons why we have difficulty ascribing emotions to God, is that human emotions often get out of control. I mean, we all know in ourselves and in our relationships with others that to keep our emotions in check is sometimes a very difficult business. And so we think about God in those terms. Well, that's one of the points at where the metaphor is, there's a discontinuity in the metaphor. God's emotions do not get out of control. Now, we have to be careful. God's emotions are not sort of controlled, as if that would be a negative, sort of rigid control of one's emotions, and we'll see in some texts how that's not so, but not out of control. God is not overwhelmed by the experiences that God has, as human beings often are. God is not incapacitated, immobilized by the emotional or the feeling which God has. Nor does God waver in terms of faithfulness or loyalty or God's will for the salvation of all. in our emotional life, that there were this kind of ups and downs that human beings often have in their emotional life. Well, and so that may be, again, a factor that makes it difficult for us to talk about the emotions of God. So you need, it was over against the up and down character of human emotion, you need to talk about God's emotion in terms of it. God's faithfulness will be steady. God's love will be steadfast. There is a constancy with regard to God's commitment to us that is oftentimes not characteristic of human feeling, human emotion, and human commitments. And so there are those differences then between human emotions and divine emotions that we need to keep in mind. But we ought not sort of, okay, because there are some difficulties or perhaps even some dangers in talking about God in emotional terms because of human experience of emotions, just because there are those dangers, we ought not back off from speaking about emotions of God at all. We need rather to move right in there and talk about feelings and emotions. It's interesting that we say as Christians, and those of us who are Lutheran say it often, we say that in order to understand God best, Jesus becomes the lens through which we can see God most clearly. That Jesus revealed God to us in a way that was never the case before or since. But we're often not very consistent in our talk about Jesus as revealing God to us. Do we really want to claim that Jesus had no emotional life? Do we really want to claim that Jesus never had any feelings? I mean, just think for a moment about, Jesus coming into Jerusalem. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how often would I have gathered you as a hen gathers her brood on her wings? But you wouldn't, you wouldn't. Well, we think of Jesus at the death of Lazarus in the text very clearly. You know, the shortest verse in the Bible, Jesus wept. Are we saying that in those aspects of Jesus' life, that Jesus wasn't revealing of God? That in those times of Jesus, where Jesus displayed feelings or emotions in his ministry, that somehow that was different from who God is and the way God responds to the world? What do we mean when we say the love of God? How are you going to talk about love without talking about feeling, without talking about emotion? I mean, doesn't love by definition mean being deeply troubled and moved by what might go wrong between you and the ones whom you love? How can God be love and remain unaffected, remain unfeeling? How can God see all the suffering that is, on the part of those whom he loves and remain unfeeling in the face of all that suffering? If that's the kind of God we got, what monster must that be? God cannot remain unaffected. God truly feels in relationship to who we are and what we were undergoing as human beings. God cannot be love and be unresponsive, be unfeeling. Or we've got a definition of love that just has no continuity whatsoever with our normal use of that term. And again, it seems to me that when we talk about Jesus, and in Jesus' suffering, that language that we use so often for Jesus, we need to think more often of Jesus as the one who suffers, as in those ways embodying the passion of God, the suffering of God, the feeling of God, the emotions of God. So, let's now take a look at a few texts. Get into the scriptures and see what we can find there. And a couple of things about texts. Before we get into one, we often run into some difficulty in our understanding of Old Testament texts because we don't read them out loud. You need to remember that, particularly when we get into prophetic material, that originally that material was delivered orally and only subsequently written down. And so you have to hear these texts out loud before you begin to get inside them. I worry some about some of the reading of the prophets that I hear in church. I mean, it's all kind of steady and, you know, almost monotone, as if you dare not give any feeling, especially with God speaking in the text. And that occasions a problem. Well, when you'll hear me read some texts, and I will give them, and I will try to intone them in ways that I think exhibit their original intonation. I can't be sure about that, but I think I'll attempt to do some things. The second thing that we need to remember is that translators, people who have translated the Bible out of Hebrew into English and other language, are more often than not heavily infected, and that's a word I use intentionally, by this impassible, unemotional notion of God. And so the language that they use to translate some of these words is rather sort of straight and flat, rather than exhibiting some of the emotional tones. And I'm hoping that as the emotional side of God issues begin to become more and more prominent among us, that some of the translations will change and will become more reflective of the original language. I think maybe as women become more involved, now you're maybe aware of the fact that there's a new edition of the RSV coming out. It's due out in May of 1990. That's less than 2 years away. And it'll be an inclusive language edition. Not all male language will be removed, particularly that it won't be the pronoun, male pronouns for God will not be removed, for example. But in terms of human language, a great deal of it will be removed. And there have been a number of women who have been involved in this translation project, new translation project for the RSV. And I'm hoping that the feminist perspective will make itself felt in a number of ways in the language that emerges on the emotional side. I think that as women have become more and more involved in the theological enterprise, and as they have interpreted more and more texts, I think they've been especially helpful in lifting up this side of the topic for us. I'm not one to suggest that males are without feelings or without emotions and that they don't display them, but I think that it's the women among us who have helped us see the emotional side of ourselves as males in ways that we have not been able to working at this in and of ourselves. And I think women biblical scholars are going to be of great assistance to us here in lifting out some of these materials and text. So, if you will, let's turn to the prophets and let's turn first to Isaiah. First chapter. The reason why I want to point out Isaiah is that you'll notice that Isaiah is the first of the prophets, not historically now, but in the scriptures. The book immediately prior is the Song of Solomon, and then you get into Isaiah, and the rest of the Old Testament is prophetic material, except for little Lamentations in there. And so the kind of the opening statements, not only of Isaiah, but what amount to the whole prophetic corpus in the Old Testament, become important. And the opening statement of God in the book of Isaiah is a lament. And you see the feelings of God immediately apparent here, beginning with verse 2. Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth, for the Lord has spoken. Now, we're going to work this morning with two primary images for God. we're going to work for with the parental image for God, and we're going to work with the marital images for God. And the image for God here that you in this text is God as a parent. And I'll look at what God has to say. Sons have I reared and brought up, but they rebelled against me. I mean, the ox knows its owner and the ass its master's crib, but Israel does not know. My people does not understand. Right off the bat, you get a picture of God as a parent whose children have become prodigal, whose children have strayed. And God does not respond to that situation in a kind of even feeling way. God talks about the fact of God's life as a parent, and now how they have rebelled, if you will, in the face of the best parenting possible. I'm as a parent of teenagers, I'm very comforted by a text like this. as one struggles with kids growing up, and these passages in the prophets, and not only here, and we'll get to a few others, very, very comforting. Here you see God as a parent with rebellious children. And how does God respond in the face of the prodigality of the children? Does God strike out in sort of sheer almightiness in the face of these straying children? No. God chooses to suffer the pangs of parenthood rather than to strike out and in some, you know, muscle-oriented fashion. And you can see the lament of God here. Let's go on. Let's turn to the next book, Jeremiah. Chapter 2. First chapter is the call of Jeremiah. And so the beginning of the words of the prophets are in chapter 2. And Jeremiah begins with a marital metaphor, God as a spouse. The word of the Lord came to me, saying, "Go and proclaim in the hearing of Jerusalem, thus says the Lord." I remember. Isn't that wonderful? Think about that for a moment. God saying, "I remember the devotion of your youth, your love as a bride." You know, when a marriage goes wrong, when there's divorce, when there's separation, one of the common things that happen is a recollection of those memories of how good things used to be when we were first married, those first months, those first years together. And that's here you find that in God. I remember how things were back then, the devotion of your youth, your love as a bride, and how you followed me in the wilderness in a land not sown. Israel then was holy to the Lord, the first fruits of his harvest. But all the weight of it became guilty, and evil came upon them, says the Lord. God as a spouse whose marriage has gone wrong. And in verse 5, you get a shift again, and you pick up God as a parent. Thus says the Lord, "What wrong did your fathers find in me that they went far from me, and they went after worthlessness and became worthless?" I mean, where did I go wrong? Tell me, where did I go wrong? What wrong did your fathers find in me? I mean, really, haven't I been the best parent possible? Look at verse 29 following, chapter 2. God speaking, why do you complain against me? I mean, you've all rebelled against me, says the Lord. Skipping down verse 31, "And you, O generation, heed the word of the Lord." I mean, have I been a wilderness to Israel or a land of thick darkness? That's a rhetorical question. No, I have not been. Why then? Why do my people say, we're free, we're not going to come anymore to you? That's not a rhetorical question. There's a why question in God's mouth that's got no answer. In the face of the best parenting possible, why? Why have the people gone astray like this? I mean, can verse 32, can a girl forget her jewelry? For heaven's sakes, not in your life. Can a bride forget her wedding dress? Never. But my people have forgotten me. Days without number, they've forgotten me. How can you read that without seeing the feeling in God? Look at chapter 3, beginning with verse 19. This is one of those rare texts in the Old Testament. There aren't all that many, probably about a dozen, where what we call a divine soliloquy, God talking to himself, if you will. Now, theologians often tell us, you know, you can't know the mind of God, you can't kind of get on the inside workings of God, but there are a few texts which do kind of let you in once in a while, and this is one of them. And it begins, I thought. What does it mean for you now to begin to hear God say, I once thought? That's kind of inner divine reflection, huh? And it's God as a parent. Listen, I thought, you know, back then, you know, when we first started this parental stuff, this relationship, parent and child, I thought how I would set you among my sons, my children, we could translate. I've set you among my children and give you a pleasant land, a heritage most beauteous of all nations. And I thought back then, you know, I thought you would call me my father and that you wouldn't turn from following me. That's what I thought. But look what's happened. And then all of a sudden there's a shift in the metaphor. And now you move in verse 20 to a marital metaphor. Move from the parent to the spouse. Surely, as a faithless wife leaves her husband, so you've been faithless to me, O house of Israel, says the Lord. Now, you know, you get some literary purists who say, the prophet's mixing metaphors here. He moves from God as parent to God as spouse, and, you know, what's that? Well, what's the force of it? The force of it is that God is rejected both as a parent and as a spouse. And you put those images side by side, and can you see the force? Can you see the force of the rejection? That God here is being rejected at multiple levels of intimacy. All those close to him have left God. Huh? They've rejected God. And God doesn't respond to that in some kind of even-handed, level way, for heaven's sakes. What kind of a God would that be? Huh? Who simply responds sort of even-handedly, you know, without emotion to the fact that everyone close has left home? Or turn to chapter 8. Beginning with verse 4. You shall say to them, thus says the Lord. By the way, we're working in prophetic material primarily because there are sort of larger tracts of direct God speech that you find in the prophets compared to the more historical books. They're the speaking of God is a little bit less common. But here you find long stretches of direct speech from God. You shall say to them, thus says the Lord. When people fall, don't they get up again, for heaven's sake? Well, there's a rhetorical question. And if people go away, don't they come back? Sure. I mean, grab my point? Okay. Why? Why has this people turned away in perpetual backsliding? There's a question. That's not a rhetorical question. Why? There's not an answer to that. Why? I mean, look. They hold fast the deceit. They refuse to return. I mean, I've given heed. I've listened. I've been the best parent. I've been the best spouse possible. But they have not spoken aright. No person repents of their wickedness, saying, you know, what have I done? Everyone turns to his own course like a horse plunging headlong into battle. And then you get the reference to the animals again, like we did back at the beginning of Isaiah. I mean, the stork in the heavens, she knows her times. And the turtle dove, and the swallow, and the crane, I mean, they keep the time of their coming. They know when to migrate and when not to migrate. But my people, they don't know the ordinances of the Lord. There's no feeling here. There's no emotion here. Turn to one other. Hosea, Jeremiah, Lamentations, Ezekiel, Daniel, Hosea. Turn to chapter 6 for first, and then I think that at this point, you have to begin to ask the question, what kind of God is it who stands behind this kind of talk? Is that Superman? Is that an absolute monarch? No, we've got to work on our images of God. We've got that, you know, that stern, absolute monarch, king, almighty judge, all that language. That's all we use. That's 99% of our God talk. And how are you going to reconcile that kind of God talk with this kind of language? God, who is deeply, deeply affected by what's happened to the relationship between God and people. A God whose heart is deeply wounded is what has happened here. What kind of God is that? Is that talk compatible with a God who's in absolute control of the situation? Good. How can you bring together a God who's in absolute control of the situation in this kind of conversation? Look at Hosea, chapter 6. Look at verse 4. Can you hear it? What shall I do with you, O Israel, Ephraim? What shall I do with you, O Judah? God has no answers, finally, you know, to these questions. What shall I do? Turn to chapter 11. This is such a wonderful chapter. It's among a handful of my most favorite chapters in the whole scriptures. I wish that we could hear them a little bit more often. On Thursday, when we talk about the issues of sexuality in God, we want to come back to this chapter a little bit. You think, just as we read through it, what kind of God is it? Is this a father? Is this a mother? Is this what are the images that come to mind for you here? And we won't address the sexuality issues today, but listen to the emotional tones in this chapter too as we read. When Israel was a child, I loved him. And out of Egypt, I called my son or my child. But the more I called them, the more they went from me. And I mean, they kept sacrificing to the Baals and burning incense to idols. Yet it was I who taught Ephraim, Israel, to walk, and I took them up in my arms. But they didn't know that I healed them. I mean, I led them with cords of compassion and with the bands of love, and I became to them as one who eases the yoke on their jaws. I bent down to them, and I fed them. Then skipping to verse 7, but my people are bent on turning away from me, and so they're appointed to the yoke, and no one shall remove it. I mean, how can I give you up, O Ephraim? I mean, how can I hand you over, O Israel? How can I make you like Admah? How can I treat you like Zeboiim, two cities that were destroyed along with Sodom and Gomorrah? Listen to this language. My heart recoils within me. My compassion grows warm and tender. I will not execute my fierce anger. I will not turn to destroy Ephraim, for I'm God and not a human being. Holy cow. You would have thought that maybe the final statement there should have been, I'm a human being and not God, given all the emotion and all the feeling tones that were there in the previous verses. But no, after all of this kind of language with regard to the commitment to the children and the working of the children and the way God has been involved in their lives, aha, that way of God with the children is a way that reveals that God is God and not a human being. But the emotional tones, they're all there to see. You get a glimpse into the heart of God, a heart that is throbbing, pathos, and concern, and genuine feeling for what is going on. Why do the prophets say these kinds of things? This is preaching of the prophets to the people. An audience of Israelites would have heard this. Why do the prophets convey all this feeling, the feelings of God, the emotions of God, to the audience? Let me conclude with a personal illustration. It's a touch too personal, I apologize. A few years ago, we were having some difficulty with our younger daughter. And so we decided to go to a counselor as a family and to try to see if we couldn't work this through together. And we were kind of naive, I think, in all of this, and we're kind of expecting maybe the counselor would sort of focus in on the child and that sort of thing. But for the first few times together, all of the focus was on the parents. And the primary concern of the counselor was to elicit from us our feelings, our emotions, our sufferings, our hurts, our pains, all that kind of language, just try to draw that out of us. And in the presence of the family. And it was about the second or third time when all of a sudden it hit me that that's exactly what the prophets are doing here. That they are, if you will, placarding before the people of Israel how God feels, how God is suffering, the pain of God with respect to the rejection and the prodigality and the rebelliousness of the children, in the hopes that when the children see this pain and suffering of God displayed before them, that it will elicit a change of heart. It'll turn them from their present ways into more loving and mature paths. I think that's what the prophets are about. Does it say something about the kind of witness that we ought to have as Christians to the God who is ours? Ought we not be sharing the feelings of God more with others? The emotions of God. How God has been affected by the way in which the world has treated him. Is it possible that if the people hear and see more of these feelings of God and the emotions of God, that they will be drawn to this God in a way that's not the case if we've got them a stern God who's always steady and who is simply left brain? Think about it. Well, let's talk a little bit here.
Harry, I'd like to say something. A couple of nights ago, Elmer's sermon was directed against the, well, I should say directed against, but he spoke about clinical pastoral education as being something that gets in the way of ministry, and that it's predominantly psychological, and that it might be better oriented towards pre-seminarians. And yet it's been my orientation that much of what goes on in seminary tends to be left brain. We're very rationally oriented. We're work, study, get ahead, stressed. And that most of what we do in the seminary tends to be intellectual and lacking in feeling. And when we do express frustration or impatience or antagonism, it's seen as authority reaction, or maybe lacking in self-awareness or honesty. And then we get the feeling that we should be more nice. And then Elmer noted that God is not nice. And there's a kind of a disparity there about how to get in touch with ourselves as feeling persons who can take what we're learning and studying and integrate it into the way we are. And I'm wondering, you know, you mentioned last night that there's like 60-odd openings for clergy. And yet I'm aware that there's a lot of clergy who are pulling back at this time. And I wonder if you could comment about where we are in this time as people preparing for ministry or in ministry, and how we are in terms of our understanding of being feeling persons who have a community in which we can maybe relate that feeling.
Well, I think you hit at a very important issue. Couple of things. One is I don't think there's any question that that sort of the theological curriculum, typical curriculum in seminaries, has sort of followed basic theological convictions, and that are the images that we've used for God through the centuries have informed the way in which we not only preach and teach as pastors, but the way in which we train such persons. I want to affirm your sense of things here, that our theological education has been somewhat one-sided. It's certainly left brain. No question about that. I think there have been some significant changes over the last, I've been involved in theological education for 20 years, and the last 10 as dean, so I've been a kind of a fulcrum of some of this stuff. And I've done accrediting work all across the country over the last 8 years on behalf of the Association of Theological Schools, so I've gotten inside all kinds of seminaries, all kinds of denominations. And there's really some fundamental changes that are taking place. I think it's due to a couple of things. One is the presence of women on campus has really forced significant changes in the way in which we do theological education. And a number of these women are second career people who have had a lot of experience, life experience, and they've forced us to rethink a number of these, just exactly these matters as well as others. Second thing is there's been biblical scholarship and other scholarship that has begun to lift up these themes, and scholars of some prominence. Did I mention Heschel early on? Was that the first hour this morning? I can remember something. The bookstore has a couple of copies, I think, of Abraham Heschel's book, The Prophets. Abraham Heschel's a Jewish scholar. He taught at the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York until 1972 when he passed away. And the book on the prophets is really an astounding book. It's a book of, which is really, it's one of the five most influential books in my life. He talks about the prophets as those who feel the feelings of God, and moves through some texts to talk about this. He has what he calls the theology of pathos, and very helpful. But he stands over against most fellow Jews in this regard. His fellow Jews really took after him for this kind of talk about God. But there's literature that's beginning to appear. Moltmann's book, The Crucified God, has been very helpful in opening up some of these questions. Dorothea Zola and her work on suffering has been very helpful. The Sally McFaig on Models of God, Metaphorical Theology, very important pieces of material that have begun to get into the mix here and have begun to force some changes. So my guess is that if you finished seminary 10 years ago, 15 years ago or more, and were to come back, there would be some important changes that have taken place, not simply in the content of the curriculum, but in the methods used in the classroom and the importance of some other dimensions than what we traditionally would call left-brain stuff. But I want to add one other footnote to that. There are occasionally some signs that the mind issues and the intellectual issues are being denigrated, are being, I worry a little bit about the scales tipping the other way as I hear some people reflect on these matters. So I want to be alert to the possibility that the life of the mind and the intellectual and conceptual concerns that we have don't somehow be minimized. Yes?
Well, this certainly plays up the importance then of pastors at all times considering continuing education and doing a great deal of reading and that kind of thing to keep up with the new things that are going on in the seminaries even.
Yeah, I think that's so. I can only second. Amen. Mm-hmm. Was that a fly or a hand there?
I
was a
fly. Okay.
Yes?
My response is perhaps strange, but what I feel hearing you talk is that maybe as a community, we have a lot of grief work to do for what we have not been given in terms of images of God. How impoverished our concept of God is as a result of the language that we've been saddled with, if I can use that word. I've just been in the process of filling out an application for me to sojourn here, and one of the things that it asks for is a brief life history with some reflections about the spiritual journey. And as I've thought about that, I realized that my only concept of God as I grew up, and probably until I was 25, was God as judge. And there is no compassion, or at least my concept of God as judge included no compassion. And and that's a real misfortune.
I appreciate that comment. I think there is some grieving maybe that's needed here, that we have been impoverished to some degree by limited images for God that we've grown up with and been presented with. I don't want to, however, finally discard the judging images. I think the way in which you began to talk there was important. How can we bring the judging images together with these feeling and compassion images? And tomorrow we're going to talk a little bit about anger and judgment, and I hope now to, and given this kind of conversation, that we can come at the issues of judge with a different context, in a different context. I think in a few with theological circles nowadays, there's some tendency to take these powerful images for God, the judge images, the king images, the authoritarian father images, and to, if not discard them, at least place them on the back burner. And my concern here is to not to discard them, not to set them aside, but they need to be transformed. We need to look at them anew in the light of these other images. And these other images will help nuance them and bring them, I think, into a more appropriate level of appropriation and understanding on our part. But it takes some doing, and it may be that some people are right. You've got to place them on the back burner for a while and put them aside for a while and lift these others up and let them fill the room. And then come back, and then come back. And it's only when you let the pendulum swing a little past center that you can get back to center. There are some important issues here that we're working with at the present time. I appreciate your own personal testimony to that matter. Yes?
Don't you think that as we grow older and study more diligently, that we have our own, not only our own concept, but it's tempered somewhat by our living and our believing and our reading? Because I find some of this, what the seminary does, that's all by rote. What does that person feel? Hasn't he come to believe that God is a father and he both soft and harsh when necessary? Just as we are?
Just as we are. There's the rub. is Scandinavian fatherhood like that? I mean, for example, I mean, or it's... I think that commonly we live with certain human images that distort some of these dimensions of the divine. But the first part of your comment is of great interest to me. What I heard you say was that as one grows older, some of these images begin to soften some and mellow some, and they begin to flow together a little bit more. And it would be interesting to see whether or not that is in fact the case as one went from sort of older person to older person on these matters. My sense of things is that, that may be true.
I'll admit I'm a maverick, but I find it true myself.
Yeah.
And I think it comes from study and contemplation.
Yeah. Okay, yes?
I think without listening to other people, if you just study on your own, you're going to get your own mindset more and more ingrained. You see more and more of what you already thought.
Yeah.
But as you listen to other people, you get in the loop.
My sense of things is that you will become what you have been, and unless you really open yourself up to community on this part, in this, on these various issues. Yes, Beth.
Well, as much what ties in with your belief in what the will of your attitude, the will of God is. What you said yesterday, I just kept thinking that. You think it's a judge that's up there authoritarian and zapping you. I was thinking and experiencing of grief. You think God is a comforter, just comes as a zapping a comforter, or is it really that God relates to you because he wanted everyone to be perfect, wanted everyone to have life, and is grieving because the world went awry, and also can feel the way you feel, then you really identify.
Yeah.
So it has to be a human.
Yeah, some of that language you use is very helpful. If you think of the full range of the person that you are, if God is only able to touch base with your intellectual side, you know, if God can't touch feelings to feelings, emotions to emotions, that makes God's relationship to you limited. In the sense, we really limit God by suggesting that God can only relate to that more intellectual side of our being. That's very nice, that being able to touch base with each and every aspect of who we are. Yes?
Right before we left Washington, D.C., the movie The Last Temptation of Christ had come out, and we hadn't seen it, so I can't about that, but there were groups that were protesting the show and groups that were all for it. And they had an article in the paper. They had interviewed several theologians in the city, and there were mixed views from both. Some thought it was refreshing and really touched them, and they felt a real connection with the whole the life of Christ, and others who were very uncomfortable with this portrayal.
I've not seen it yet either. And given the reviews, I don't know if I will. But I think that's a pertinent matter. I think that from what I read of the reviews, that there is a range of emotion and feeling side of Jesus that's lifted up in the movie that probably somewhat uncomfortable, but certainly not used to, if not. Mm-hmm.
Which I wonder how closely it follows the book. This is not a new book.
Right, it's a late 1940s book, so it's, I don't know that. Yes?
I think it is, it's probably that it touches Jesus with the concept of sexuality. I mean, that's what's, it isn't the emotion, it's the sexuality.
I think it's probably both, but the sexuality is certainly prominent there. There was a hand back in the back row there. Other comments? Yes, there.
You mentioned those texts that you read. Why aren't some of those included in the texts that our pastors get, you know, to preach on?
Yeah. You see, you put your finger on a problem. Just another. If in fact you have certain images of God that predominate in the life and thinking of the church, those who make decisions on the lectionary text to be read on Sunday morning are going to look at those texts that are most in tune with the perspectives that they have. If I'm on the committees that pick the text, there are going to be a few different texts getting there, okay?
Who sends the lectionary?
Excuse me?
Who sends the lectionary?
Well, it all depends upon who's part of those committees at a given point in the life of the church. I mean, I assume it comes through sort of worship-oriented people in different, you know, different denominations who get together and work on these matters. Yes, Evelyn.
I was thinking after Betty's response. Betty is an artist, and I think a good deal has been made of God has to be an artist. Now that's right-brain stuff. I mean, when you think about the beauty of the creation and why the birds have all these colors and all of this kind of thing, that the whole idea of the beauty of creation affirms someone who appreciates and loves beauty, which is right brain stuff, and it's not just an intellectual God.
Yeah, that's
the
very
song,
important.
I mean, the sounds look like
very, that's very important, very helpful. I think if you begin to move, if you start unpacking that particular observation, there are dimensions here to God that we've hardly begun to touch. That's right. Yes?
Is the New Testament God going to be different from the Old Testament God that you're presenting to us in images?
I hope not. Now, tomorrow we're going to talk a little bit about anger and all. Actually, one of the things I'm very concerned about as an Old Testament professor is I think the Old Testament's gotten a lot of bad press. And one of my reasons for lifting up texts like this is that we don't commonly hear these texts read from the Old Testament. When do you have Sunday school lessons that lift up these texts for children? They plow them into the holy wars back there in Joshua, and then they got Sodom and Gomorrah with fire and brimstone falling all over the place. Those are the texts that get lifted up for our attention, not these texts. It comes back to the lectionary question. It's not simply lectionary. It's what texts are picked for Sunday school lessons, what texts are picked, you know, for a general study in the life of the church. And I want to finally say, hey, this God that we see in these texts has fundamental continuity with the God that we see in Jesus. That the Father of Jesus Christ is the God of the Old Testament. And Jesus didn't come to save us from God. God sent Jesus. And it's the God of the Old Testament who sent Jesus. And so what we see in Jesus is the heart of God. And I think that heart of God is something that's evident again and again. I've just begun to touch the Old Testament texts. And we just need to pay more attention to what's in fact there. I see it's a minute past 10 o'clock. We've got to quit. Thank you very much for today.